Welcome, everybody. It's 4 o'clock in Kuala Lumpur. Am I right?
That's correct, Chair.
Okay, welcome, everybody. Do we have any apologies? Welcome in particular, obviously, to National Treasury. Do we have any apologies?
Yes, Chair. On our side, it's Mr. Ogamp. He has tendered his apology.
Okay, so when you say outside, we're referring to CCOP, obviously. There's nobody else here apart from our committee. Am I right?
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. National Treasury, you're here, right? So welcome, and let's go for it. Who's speaking on behalf of National Treasury initially? The DG. Okay, welcome, DG. Okay, let's have it. Normally, as you know, DG is about 45 minutes
thank you,
or so.
Thank you, Chair.
You can take up to an hour if you want, but, you know, then that allows exchanges. And then if there are things that you would have otherwise said in the initial input that you didn't get a chance to, you can come back. Okay, over to you, DG. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Chair, and good afternoon, honorable members. Chair, I'm not alone. I'm with Dr. Duncan Peters, who is the Deputy Director General responsible for Economic Policy. And I have officials with also Chief Director in the division, Yolanda Smith, the Chief Director, and some of the colleagues in the National Treasury, and also Vuyo Guma, who's also Chief Director in the division. So it's a holistic presentation around the state as requested by the Chair. And Dr. Peters is going to lead, with your permission, Chair, he's going to lead the presentation for us, and then we can then come in at the end again if need be. Thank you, Chair. I'll give it over to Dr.
Peters. All right. Thank you for such a big team. I know it's a bit unfair to impose on you at this time, given the millions of challenges you have, not least because of the July events. But thank you for that. Yes, we know most, if not all, of your colleagues. Go ahead, sir. The next speaker is Duncan.
Good afternoon, Chair and honorable members. I hope you are able to see my screen.
Yeah, we can see the slide presentation. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Thank you, Chair. I will then jump straight into the presentation. As the DG has indicated, some of my colleagues are with me and can certainly come in when we get to the, if there are any questions. We were asked to just discuss with the committee our view on the economic impact of the recent unrest. And I should say, Chair, before I start, we welcome this opportunity. I think in the past, whenever we have engaged with the committee, which is usually around the time of the budget and the MTBPS, we always indicate our willingness to come and engage the committee on the research that we're doing, on the technical work that we're doing. And of course, this is something that we've been thinking about for the last few weeks in preparation also for the MTBPS. So we really appreciate this opportunity to share with the committee our work. To start, and some of this work, Chair and honorable members, you will be familiar with, but what we have tried to do is just synthesize some of the key salient facts, and hopefully that can generate the right kind of discussion. So it's clear to us that the recent unrest that occurred mainly in Gauteng and KZN is going to weigh on GDP growth. And I'll get later to our exact assessment of by how much, but I thought we should just start with the context. So, of course, we know that KZN and Gauteng account for about 50% of national GDP. KZN, which bore the brunt of the unrest, alone count for about 16%. So these are big provinces. And, of course, anything that materially affects their economic prospects will have an impact on national GDP. The South African Property Owners Association has indicated that the cost of the unrest in KZN alone will exceed about 20 billion, and they estimate the national impact on GDP to be about 50 billion. Over 200 shopping malls were targeted, 1,787 retailer stores were damaged, and there are indications that that will take some time to rebuild. The reason, Chair and honorable members, we focus particularly on the retail sector, although we will touch on some of the other sectors, is because the retail sector is a very employment-intensive sector. It's one of the sectors in our economy with the highest employment multipliers. So anything that happens in the sector does have implications for unemployment. And so we do expect the damage to the retail industry to exacerbate unemployment, particularly in the third quarter of this year. Already some initial estimates from the Gauteng provincial government indicates that about 14,500 jobs were affected. And there have been other estimates by Intellidex, for example, indicating that 150,000 jobs are at risk. The rebuilding process itself will contribute positively to GDP. But of course, there's also the uncertainty related to the unrest itself, which is likely to remain in the near term. And we saw that in our macro fundamentals. If we look at the rising risk premium and the weakening of the currency, which I'll get to shortly, which both will have implications for our investment prospects. There were reports of unrest in other provinces, but the damage there appears to be limited. If I then move on to the next slide, we just go through how some of the sectors in the economy were affected by the unrest. And again, we've all been following this closely, so this is not necessarily new to us, but I think it helps to paint a picture of why the economic impact potentially is as severe as we think it's going to be. The transport sector was impacted by various supply chain interruptions, including the movement of trucks, fuel shortages, rail line disruptions, and so on. And of course, we know about the specific disruptions to Durban and Richards Bay port operations, the rail link along the Durban corridor, as well as the road transport along the N3 corridor. The agricultural sector was particularly impacted in KZN through limited market access, but the market access and transport disruptions were limited. Mainly transport trucks unable to reach dairy farms, unable to send livestock to abattoirs, mills that were unable to process burnt sugarcane, and for a period as well, citrus exports were suspended. That, of course, will have an impact on input costs, food supplies, as well as prices of food and food inflation. The mining sector is relatively resilient, because of a favorable pricing environment, and we see that in the statistics around mineral sales, but the unrest may still have an impact on the sector. We do know that there were some mines who closed operations as preventative measures. Finally, some more detail on the manufacturing side. There were some damage to manufacturing plants and lingering logistics issues that constrained the sector. SAPREF, which obviously produces quite a lot of the country's fuel, was temporarily shut down, its refinery. The LG plant in Durban was affected. There was a new clothing factory in Isithebe Industrial Park. Tiger Brands, SAB, Toyota Motors, all of these big companies in the manufacturing sector that were affected. I think it's important, Chair and Honourable Members, for us to also reflect the fact that small businesses actually accounted for about, according to some estimates, 89% of the businesses impacted by the unrest. And I think this is quite important because these are often businesses that are very vulnerable, that are not insured, and that were also highly negatively impacted beyond some of the big companies that I just mentioned. And at least at the stage when this research was completed, only about 6% of those businesses were open as usual, while many of the businesses in those riot-affected provinces were actually closed, some permanently so. And I think that obviously does not bode well, particularly for this sector the employment prospects therein. To now move, Chair and Honourable Members, to the macro fundamentals. So, of course, we keep a close eye on many of our macro fundamentals because they have big implications for the fiscal framework. there was an impact on our risk premium. And our risk premium, as we explain in this slide and as the members know, is simply the additional interest that the buyers of our debt demand in order to continue to buy our debt. And our risk premium decreased consistently up until about June, July this year, particularly relative to some of the other emerging markets, but it did increase. And in particular, in response to the unrest, it did increase faster compared to some of our emerging market peers. And the reason this is important is because that additional risk premium shows up immediately in our cost of borrowing and therefore our debt service costs. And I'll get back to this issue later. And I think, Chair, what's important to emphasize here is to the extent that some of these shifts remain over the longer run, they obviously do then have an impact. We can see there that other EMs had their risk premium increase as well, but it is clear that our risk premium widened faster compared to some of our emerging market peers as a result of the recent events. Between the 9th and the 19th of July, the risk premium was up 0.21 percentage points. And again, that shows up in our debt service costs and in our fiscal framework, and it does have an implication on the nature of our spending. So that's very important to highlight. Similar dynamic on the currency. Again, we can see there the red line is the dollar rand exchange rate, and that red line moving upwards shows an appreciation or strengthening of our currency. And we can see that since earlier this year, our currency has been strengthening, and it's been doing quite well relative to other emerging market peers, mainly because of what's happening on commodity prices. But of course, between the 9th and the 19th of July, the rand actually depreciated by 2.4%. Over the same period, the other emerging market currencies were basically unchanged. And that really tells us that the declines in the currency were affected by the unrest. And of course, the depreciation in our currency does show up in imported inflation because it makes the goods that we import more expensive. And of course, the instability or the volatility of the currency has its own negative consequences. The rand has recovered since, and that is mainly an international story because the Fed in the US, the Federal Reserve, indicated that they are keeping their interest rates stable, even as inflation in the U.S. is increasing, which puts less pressure on our Reserve Bank to do the same. And it obviously makes our bonds relatively attractive, which does support the value of the currency. Finally, Chair and Honourable Members, we also look at the yield curve. What the yield curve really tells us, and we keep an eye on the yield curve because it really does tell the story of our borrowing costs. And it tells us the interest rate that we pay on our debt for each maturity that we have in our debt portfolio. And so we can see there that the yield curve is fairly low and not as steep for the 1 year and 2 year debt. Because that is really our short-term debt, and that debt is really influenced by the repo rate and short-term interest rates. But on the longer end of our yield curve, the interest rates are much higher. And that is because investors need to be rewarded via the risk premium for holding South African debt for much longer. And we did see our borrowing cost increase consistent with the previous picture around the risk premium. We did see our borrowing cost increase in response to the unrest. And they have recovered somewhat. The 10-year bond, which is the sort of benchmark bond that we look at, was trading at 9.06% on the 9th of July, compared to 9.16% on the 19th of July. And it then recovered somewhat to 9.12 on the 22nd of August. And similar dynamics for our 30-year bond yield. And this really does mean that whenever this kind of event happens, the uncertainty that it generates then causes investors to demand a higher interest rate, which shows up in our debt service cost. We are often asked why the yield curve is such an important indicator. And as I said on the previous slide, just to give some more color to why even these small movements in our yield curve can be important, as I indicated previously, it shows the interest rate payable on the government debt issuances at different maturities. So the longer the maturity, the higher the interest rate payable. Of course, it's not possible to issue all of our debt in the short term because that increases the refinancing risk. And that is just the risk that we won't be able to pay the debt when it does become due. And of course, our yield curve therefore determines our total debt service cost. And over time, this higher cost of borrowing translates into higher debt service costs. For the 2021 fiscal year, our debt service costs were estimated at 233 billion compared to 247 billion that we spend on health and 219 billion that we spend on or that were allocated for peace and security. So again, Chair and Honourable Members, that gives one a sense of not only the quantum of our debt servicing cost burden relative to other parts of the budget, but it illustrates why understanding and keeping an eye on these macro dynamics is so important, because if our yield curve shifts up, immediately it feeds through into a higher debt service burden. To lower our debt service cost and create more room for other spending, such as other social spending, we have to lower the interest rates we pay on our debt, and we can really only achieve that in three ways, which is by running a lower budget deficit, which improves the sovereign risk premium and helps to bring down the cost of borrowing, through higher economic growth, which is why the structural reform agenda is so important, and through lower inflation, which improves the real return of our debt and therefore its attractiveness. Coming back therefore, Chair, to the impact of the unrest on growth, our assessment in our latest forecast, which will be again updated at the time of the MTBPS, is that the economic damage from the unrest could reduce our GDP growth estimate for 2021 by anything from 0.7 percentage points to 0.9 percentage points, which is quite a significant shift in 2021. This shock does not account for some of the value chain disruptions and some of the second round effects. But what is important also to add is that when you review the literature on these kinds of shocks, it is clear that the GDP does still remain below the pre-shock levels for some time, and in general for at least 6 quarters after the shock has happened, like this unrest. And that really comes to the longer term impact that a shock like this has on investor sentiment and potentially the scarring effects on employment. So people who lose their jobs, who no longer have those jobs, cannot spend and participate in the economy like they were able to. And that also has longer term growth impacts. And those longer term growth impacts, in fact, outlive the shock and do have an impact on potential growth. So that's really how we think about it. We think about the initial impact on GDP, but also the longer term impact on GDP through the shifts in employment and sentiment. It is possible that the recent unrest will likely impede some of the momentum that we've seen in the economy, particularly driven by what's happening on commodity prices and what's happening on the global recovery. And that's really because there has been damage, obviously, to commercial property. There will be some rebuilding, but that does impact on economic activity. It does affect the income of households, and it does constrain business confidence. We are already seeing some early signs of economic impacts in the purchasing managers index data and car sales data for July that has come through. And of course, the unrest does not bode well for business confidence. So it is something, Chair and Honourable Members, that we are keeping an eye on in terms of some of the permanent impacts of the recent unrest and what that means for the macroeconomic forecast that we will be releasing at the time of the MTBPS. That was the last slide, Chair and Honourable Members, from our side. I think I'll hand back to the DG or yourself for further engagement. Thank you.
DG?
Thank you very much, Chair. So I'll tell you why we decided to stop here. We decided to stop here because as practice, and Duncan Ennis on the note that says the new forecast and the thinking beyond will only be articulated at the time of the medium-term budget policy statement. Now, most of that information is market sensitive, as you can imagine, in terms of now what are our new estimates and what is the thinking now that we have given an SEs and the implication of what happens on the economy. We are currently internalizing this. We are currently looking at various scenarios and modeling whatever is there so that when we come to the medium-term budget policy statement, we come with proper real estimates. Now, the other reality is that with the situation as is, we all know that GDP growth has got a direct impact in terms of tax revenues, and tax revenues therefore has got a direct impact of how we approach our fiscal policy options that you may present at the time of the budget. So we'll be looking at that very closely, the impact on the fiscal, what these numbers suggest insofar as our debt situation is concerned, including where we see the economy going. So on that note, Chair, we're stopping here because most of them, the implications of what Duncan said can only then be finalized and come through at the time. And the market obviously knows and expects that. That come around the time of the MTBPS will be giving new estimates in terms of our revenue vis-a-vis the growth and the assumptions that goes in the budget that we'll be presenting. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much. Look, what you're saying seems sensible to me, at least. I don't know what other members will think. But secondly, just to let you know, in fairness, you are not meant to appear today. We were hoping to process the bill that's stuck because the NA changed its plenary programs last week in view of the unrest. So we were going to have hearings today. And then Nkululeko came to me and said, what do we do? So it did strike me, DG, that it's a bit premature to ask you to come because you're still finding your feet. The unrest has only occurred and it's still simmering in some respects. And it's too early to ask you to say what the impact is on the economy. But on the other hand, it also occurred to us that, look, the closer we get to MTBPS, firstly, you're over busy. Secondly, you're not likely to say much to us, given that the MTBPS reveals, as you say, all these market sensitive and other issues that you need to pull together. So I think you're being reasonable. It is a bit brief, 22 minutes. But you know what? I can't say that you need to speak more than you have to or, say things that, undermine the work you're doing, a work in progress that you're preparing for the MTBP. So I'm cool about what you've said. I think it's fine. Let me hand over to members for their comments and so on. Nkululeko, can you help me? Who wants to speak? There's Dennis Ryder, Mr. Jitoy, Mr. Alkam. Who else?
I think those are the only three hands, Chair.
Only three, yeah. Now, Nkululeko, you need to guide me about, what's his name, Dennis, right? So last week when he heard that I wasn't going to be here, Secretary, he decided not to attend the meeting because he said, what's the point of coming since there's nobody to fight with, right? And the chair who took over from me, Mr. Njadu, is too pleasant to fight with. So he decided not to come. So I handed over to my guru, Frank Jenkins, and asked him whether I could sue for defamation, Dennis Ryder. And he told me, I've only got a slim chance. So, Dennis, I'll allow you to speak, but I haven't forgotten why you didn't attend last week's meeting. By the way, for those of you who really think I'm serious, actually, I am. Okay, Dennis, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yeah, I wish it was a light-hearted reason that led me to leave or to miss last week's meeting, but it was a bit more serious and sad. Anyway,
yes,
it's fun. Yeah, it was a good coincidence that we both missed and neither of us had sparring. I had to go and fight with my wife instead. Chairperson, yes, thanks for the presentation, gentlemen. And I think we can all see that the impact is already there. And going forward, I mean, it's going to take us quite some time. I would like to understand a little bit, and perhaps the DG can inform us about SASRIA's involvement. And we've seen that the claims from SASRIA are already starting to roll in. And there's also been an indication that the SASRIA claims are going to be substantially more than initially thought, kind of upwards of 20 billion. And I know that that's going to affect Treasury a little bit. If you can just let us know if there's existing funding for that, or is there going to be money that will need to come from other sources in order to make sure that people are covered for that? Chair, yeah, I think, as you said, you know, it's going to take some time for the full depth of this to be understood and the impact to be felt. So, yes, in due course. But
hi, Chair. I think Mr. Ryder is done.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Oh, because the thing went blank the screen. I don't know why. Let me not put the video on, okay? I don't know why. The screen just went blank, okay? So basically, Dennis, you're over. So next, please, and then Willie. The next is Mr. Jutoy, I think. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation, National Treasury. Initially, when the budget was put to table in February this year, the previous minister, Mboweni, said that God forbid we have a next wave of COVID, and that happened. It's evident that South Africa can't afford to pay this poverty relief grants that is currently being paid out, in spite of the fact that we've got such a large amount of people that are unemployed and struggling to get by on a daily basis. What struck me was before we went into the constituency period, Honorable Karim mentioned that during a discussion in one of our meetings, he said that would it be cheaper to pay this 350 rand grant rather than seeing unrest in the country. So I don't know if he is currently under investigation, as he preempted this, but it's I just noted it, and I would like to know how he knew this might happen. But that's aside, I want to know from National Treasury, what effect will a second SA shutdown have on the economy? It's evident from what you've showed in your presentation that we are already feeling the brunt of what happened here, that South Africa is currently under a spotlight by investors. It's evident that what's happening in the country with regards to the land bank that has been downgraded and the effect that it has on the development bank of the country, that we might see more treacherous times that lies ahead. So firstly, what effect will the second shutdown have on the economy of the country? And where does the funds come from, or where did the funds come from, that is currently being used for these 350 rand payouts? That's number one. Number two, the additional deployments of SAPs as well as the SANDF, support being given to small and medium businesses. Obviously, those expenses hasn't been budgeted for. Where will the additional funds come from, and should we have a second chaotic incident of a week or more? Is there any way for the country to recover from that, since the debt service costs will just rise? And it's evident that the tax base is getting smaller and smaller, and less money is going into the fiscus. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, next is Willie.
Thank you, Eunice. Yeah, I'm glad that I'm not fighting with you. I would like to see you in person so that we can have a good chat and a fight and a laugh and everything. But yeah, thank you, Dennis, Eunice. Thank you for the presentation. I think what is hitting us all right in front of the head is taking us back to what the former Minister of Finance said when he passed his budget. He said that we've got absolutely no room for error. And apart from what happened with all these riots, we were making mistakes even before that. And then this came, if one look at the short-term effect of this, it must at least have a, as you said, 0.02-0.9%, let's make it rounded and say 1% effect on our GDP. My question is, what are we going to do financially should something like this happen again in the near future? We all know that we have been warned over the past week that riots might flare up again and something might happen. What is going to be the effect should this, not in the long term, but in the short term, flare up again? And how are we going to mitigate that? The other thing that I think is very important to have a look at is that every time something happens, there's a huge effect on our borrowing costs and our downgrades, etc. And as we just saw in this presentation, it happened now again, where our borrowing cost now stands at 233 billion, whereas our health budget is at 247 billion. In other words, in a pandemic, we know it's going to have a long-lasting effect on us, this pandemic. We are sitting with a cost of borrowing that is almost the same as our health budget. And then we sit with a peace and security budget that is less than our borrowing cost. Now, what happens there is we all know due to poor peace and security, riots like this play up. Due to the flare up of riots, we will have an ever increasing borrowing cost. So it's a double whammy. It's like a snowball effect. We need to look at this and to ask ourselves in long term, now this is political, where does all these problems come from? The long term outlook, we don't know what it is. As you just said there in your presentation, we don't know what the long term outlook is going to be. We don't know what this is going to have. The knock on effect is going to be on employment, or in this case, unemployment, and what further effects this might even have on our borrowing costs, because we are going more and more to a socialistic state where you have less people working that must look after more people out of employment. One of my big things that I want to ask, the big drive behind this whole thing, is that, as Minister Mboweni said, we've got no margin for error. And we have said from the DA side in the past a lot of times that expropriation of land without compensation will have an effect, such as some other things as well. But I think expropriation is one of the big issues. And I just came from expropriation public hearings that took place in my province in Northern Cape this week. And one of the things that I thought about and that hits me is the fact that we are getting downgraded, and we know that cost of borrowing are going up. But we know that also that one of the things that might lead to that, or that has led to that, is the way not only the riots that happened, but also stuff like expropriation of land without compensation and other problems that we had, the Zondo Commission and some of the stuff that came out of that as well. My question to you is, what would your advice be with regards to any actions that will lead to us being further downgraded? Firstly, and that might have a negative effect on our long and short term, but especially our long-term borrowing costs. Shouldn't we get to a point where we agree with Minister Tito Mboweni, former Minister Mboweni, and say that we've got no margin forever? We can't pursue things like that will push us back and will increase our costs, and that will put South Africa at the back foot. I would like to hear your comments on that. My last question, just a quick one, is on slide 6. You showed the graph between the currencies, the rand dollar situation, and the other emerging markets. And what was very interesting for me on that thing is that, on that graph, is that the other emerging markets are much more stable. It's a much more stable graph even before the July unrest that we had. Why is it that South Africa, that our rand versus the dollar has much more fluctuations than other emerging markets? I'm asking that because I do not know the answer to that. I can't see why that should be the situation. If you can assist me in that, I'll appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Willie. Is there anybody else who wants to speak?
Yes, Chair.
Ah, yes, Simon. Yes, welcome. Go ahead, Simon.
Thank you, Chair. Let me acknowledge the presentation. Having seen that, being aware actually that there was no budget that was meant for what happened in KwaZulu-Natal, in KZN, Gauteng. One wonders whether is there going to be enough money to foot the bill for the expansion that has been made to keep the security personnel in those provinces. What makes me to ask this is because of what was going around here, whereby the soldiers were complaining that they don't have enough food to, they were not given enough food to eat. Hence, I'm asking whether there will be enough money to keep them in those provinces until that time that has been given. Thank you, Chair.
Hi, colleagues. I just want to draw attention to things we have picked up in the media. The source might well be Treasury, which point to the enormous impact the unrest has had. 50 billion rands lost to the GDP, 14,500 jobs. Today you said to us that SMMEs account for 89% of the businesses impacted, right? You also said only 6% of the impacted businesses are open as usual. That's stunning, right? We know it, but the figures, when they're condensed like this and presented so glaringly, I mean, they really hit you hard. You say 51% of impacted businesses in the two riot-affected provinces have closed, of which 7% have closed permanently. So there's no prospect, in other words, of them ever reviving. Then you say 44% have closed temporarily. Does this imply these 44% of businesses will, in fact, be resuscitated and function, even if in a more modest and slim form? Or is it that you don't know yet whether this 44% will, in fact, at some stage or the other, hopefully sooner rather than later, start functioning again? Now, I wanted to ask a question that, in a way, is covered by Dennis about Sastria. Now, firstly, you know, as I understand it, Sastria is funded by the state. Am I correct? Is it solely funded by the state, or do the insurance companies contract? I don't know how it actually works. I think I know, but instead of saying what I think I know and wasting the committee's time, can you tell us plainly and simply, how does Sastria actually function, where are its sources of income from, etc.? Secondly, on average, how long do you think, I suppose it depends on the business and the claims made, but in the first instance, if a small business comes to Sastria and says, you know, the cost to us, the loss to us is, let's say, 70,000 rands. Now, do you pay them once you verify that, Sastria? Does Sastria pay them the full 70,000, or it gives them a percentage, 80% or whatever? Then, on average, how long would Sastria take? So obviously, it may depend on the type of claim, the size of the business, and so on. But, you know, on the whole, let's say, the whole process, do you have any idea, or does Sastria have any idea that they've told you of how long it might take? So the first payout, so to speak, will be in the first 2-3 weeks, and some may have already been paid out. And then the last payouts will take up to 6 months from now. So if you have any of that information, perhaps you can let us have it. Otherwise, you can write to us and let us know. But at least you can give us some sense today, even if your figures are cautiously offered to us. Now, I actually think, DG, if it were possible at all, and I certainly know it isn't, certainly not for you and such a high-level team to do so, I would take this submission to, you know, all the committees. Like, you know, ideally, it should be a joint sitting of the committees, especially the economic cluster committees in both houses, but also, you know, other committees that might be seen as relevant, like COGTA and so on. But I don't know what can be done about it. Well, one option is to distribute your submission, but it's not kind of a discussion, you see. So I don't know if it's appropriate, but maybe you want to raise this with the minister. Maybe it's a bit too soon for him because he's still finding his feet and he's, you know, having to manage overall with UDG, the MTBPS, but to address the House, to issue a statement of some sort. But I know there's a debate coming up in the NA and so on. But you know, to deal, I don't know whether a House sitting is what I'm talking about, because it becomes like the subject of like rigid speeches and, you know, biases of all parties, not least my own ideological. I think committee meetings where it's an interactive thing, I don't know if such a thing can be done. Because, you know, we know, many of us, probably all of us in Parliament, public reps, what the cost has been, broadly speaking. But, you know, to receive this submission in a compact 22 minutes or so, I must tell you, DG, it's quite like, it really hits you. It's quite stunning, actually. It'll shake us up as MPs to wake up and also exercise our oversight. Also because many of the things that you talk about can't be dealt with by Treasury. I mean, we need economic growth and so on, all departments or most departments are involved. We need to secure convictions of people who are supposed to be behind the social unrest to the extent it's been planned and orchestrated by those who want the former president to be released. And I have no doubt that is there. I mean, I have myself been quite involved, needless to say, in my own hometown here in Mtsundusi. And what comes under this KZN, remember, the capital city. So I can tell you from my own observation and engagement at comrades in civil society, I have no doubt that there has been a substantial element of orchestration. So we need the departments of police and, you know, state security or the committees to be involved. They must deal with the issues that fall within their portfolio. But in the first instance, we must come to terms with what the impact economically and financially is in our country, coming as it does, the social unrest on the back of a horrific COVID-19 crisis, which we aren't even anywhere near overcoming at this stage with our surge in level 3 and a possible fourth surge pending in December, if the scientists are correct. So since issues have been raised by other colleagues about, you know, how are you preparing for the possibility of this happening? There was an expectation that there will be a second attempt orchestrated and organized on the 23rd, linked to the president's former president's release from prison and the campaign to bring down the current Ramaphosa administration. So obviously, when talking about, you know, action, firstly, it can't be Treasury alone, obviously, I think we'll all agree, but also it has to be something that there has to be some consensus within Parliament on and the various committees. So hopefully, at least your cabinet colleague, the cabinet colleagues of the minister have been briefed along these lines and will communicate that to the DGs and officials. And your colleague DGs will communicate, or they delegate to others to communicate this sort of submission. You know, ideally, I mean, you know, well, look, I will raise it with the powers that be on the SCOP side. They must engage with any. I'll do it right now for this meeting, that this sort of submission, DG. I'm not saying you must be there necessarily. If it's a collective meeting, well, you could be, and it'll be worth your while. But let's see how that goes. Remember, I can only, DG, do this unless some committee members say they disagree. But if the majority agree with me, I'll raise it. I think, in short, without belaboring the point, this should be communicated to all committees or as many committees as possible. Now, since we've come to actions that have to be taken, we have to come to better terms on the causes so that we better prepare. I agree with those who say look, this thing is likely to happen again. And there's no time now to have a long discussion on the causes, and we're not going to agree on them. But since people have raised it in some or other form, either in subtext or overtly, and I think people are free to say what they want to say, DG. There can be no rigidities about views on this. My own view, for what it's worth, is that the term riot is inappropriate. It's a politically loaded term. It's a term that many of us in our activist days treated with contempt, because that's how the apartheid regime saw the 1976 uprising. But of course, people use that term in our own rights, the majority party these days. So my own point is not to have a quibble with some or other MP here, but to say it wasn't mindless. It wasn't a riot, in my view. I think it was to be expected. It astonishes me, DG, that so many of us, especially those of us for a long time around here, have been saying this. Government documents have been saying it, DG. There's a social explosion looming. Call it whatever you will. The inequalities. Only recently, colleagues, a study shows that 10% of the country owns 85% of the wealth. For how long have all these parties, like sitting in this committee, not harped on the huge inequalities most of us have? He said it's unsustainable. Having social grants, you yourself, BG, keep saying, how long are we going to sustain with such low growth rates? But if we hadn't offered it, the country would have collapsed. So I think, I'm going on because, look, it's not even an hour. What is it, 16:46? And we've done with your input and the only three other questions. So I'm not stopping anybody else from coming back. But all I'm saying that in a nutshell, DG, colleagues, my view is simple. It may be wrong, but it's this. This thing was looming. And with COVID-19, it was looming even more. All that's happened is brought forward because of what happened with the incarceration of the former president. Yes, yes, it's been orchestrated. On that, I have no doubt. But the extent to which it was orchestrated and the extent to which it went far beyond the orchestrators is a debatable point. But most of all, for me, it was an uprising, really, against the inequalities. The poor jumped on the bandwagon, and so did the middle classes with their 4x4 trucks looking for expensive electronic goods. So all classes and strata took part. But we must not ignore the possibility it will happen again, not just because those who played a part in the instigation are still going to persist with their, it's terrorism, really, the violence that took place. It's terrorism. That's what it is. So you can discuss whether it's an attempted insurrection or not, but that should not allow us, BG, and I address this particularly to Treasury because I know your collective positions on these issues. Otherwise, knowing you as I have come since 1994 and especially since 2014, DG, we cannot distract from the fact that you cannot have a situation where you have such huge inequality, the worst in the world, and they're highly racialized. Finally, you know, I've been very, very involved here in the Khan Road settlement, where Indian vigilantes burnt down an informal settlement, small as it was, 41 households. We put up 31 again. I have been engaging with both sides as part of a team. I'm only one individual there. But I can tell you this, DG. It is heart-wrenching to listen to people say what they say. And we have to deal with these issues. They are racialized. If you look, DG, in that Khan Road area, just to give you one glimmer of insight, I'm not being parochial here. I'm just making a general point about the country as a whole. It takes you less than 30 seconds to cross the road. These people live in informal settlements, right, in shacks. 27 years, DG, beyond our democracy. You're not to blame. We all are to blame. Finally, it's us, parliamentarians, especially those like me who've been here since 1994. They look across the road in the deepest winter. We're at minus two degrees winter here, which is unusual for our town. They look across the road. They see a three-bedroom house with electricity, obviously heating two cars in the driveway. And they look at that and they say, now look at this. Right? These people came to this country, they don't know when, of Indian descent. I have been here for a long time. We can talk about the Khoisan also, right? But the point I'm trying to make is, you know what? This is going to happen again and again, long after the Zuma campaigners have actually dissipated or the issue or the cause they're fighting has fallen away. So we have to address the structural inequalities. I'm saying to you now, that's the biggest lesson. And you've got two big lessons as government and us as parliament. COVID, on the back of which has come this horrendous unrest. And my own view, DG, is going to flare up every now and then. And more, it will have to deal with the wretched of this country getting fed up with the rest of us. So I know your attitude towards, well, I would imagine, predict, I don't know enough what your personal views, what Treasury's attitude will be towards the social pension thing. Nor do I fully understand all the variables and balances you need. But one thing is clear, DG, we need a social fund for everybody, however we do it. Your current proposals of your colleagues, I'm told, is not even gone through cabinet by Department of Social Development, may not be tenable. I don't know. But what I am saying is the idea is correct. Having said that, all I'm saying is, DG, I think the members that are raising this, what are you doing? Maybe it's premature to ask you this. Maybe down the road you'll have to come with clearer answers. What are we doing to prepare this? Okay, we can't have the SANDF out there all the time. We can't have the police out there all the time. But we can do something as a government to reduce the inequalities. That won't end our problems, DG, but it'll substantially reduce them. Thank you. Sorry for going on so long. It's only not even an hour. Am I right, my friend? It's only 16:51 minutes. I don't normally talk so long. Dennis will titter there and maybe Jutoy, right? The truth is I don't talk for so long. But the point is that we've got 2 hours and 10 minutes, not colleagues, not DG, as if we're going to keep you and your team here. The way I see it, we can round up in the next half an hour to an hour. We don't need 3 hours. It's an ongoing discussion, DG, only I don't like it that we're having it only with one committee. And we need to at least cohere with appropriations. Well, in our case, it's the same committee, but on that side. Thank you. And trade and industry and growth. What's that thing called? Economic. What's it called now? It's called Department of Trade, Industry and Competition. Yes. Thank you.
Hi, Chair. I see Honorable Tutoy has his hand up again.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you, Chair. I don't want to take the meeting back, but if we just keep quiet, it will. Someone might assume that we are agreeing with everything.
No, I'm sure
saying.
You don't agree with anything.
And,
I did say that.
And not contesting it. I mean, the utterances that you made that, well, there is inequalities, yes, but blaming people that are contributing to the economy for the inequalities, that's reckless. We all know that during all these meetings and committee meetings, it's always being referred to, but never being referred to by the majority party that they are the problem for the looting of the state funds and state capture that took place. And it's now also some of them still looking as it proceeds, as it's still taking place without holding their cadres, bringing them to account. And sir, with regards to the social fund, it's evident that we cannot look at that. We are already a welfare state. And rather focus on opening the economy, having equal opportunities for everyone, like we always say. I don't want to get into a debate, but I'm not going to keep quiet while you, well, you have the right to state your point. So have I. Thank you, Chair.
No one's stopping you, my friend. I know you say all these things, and some of what you say actually is not accurate. I never ever said that those who contribute to the economy. The rest of it is debatable, but just to qualify in case of a misunderstanding, colleagues, anyway, I never said those who contribute to the economy are part of the problem. Obviously not.
Yes, Chair, you mentioned that 10% of the people hold the economy still, while the majority is not taking part.
No, I didn't say that. You're misunderstanding
me. Favorable position of this.
No, I didn't say that. I'll send you the report. The report doesn't say that. The report says that 10% of the top income earners have 85% of the wealth. I'm not blaming them. I'm saying that's the structural thing. Nor am I saying it's completely racialized. I say it's highly racialized, meaning my own view is while there have been a lot of African people that have moved up into that 10% as well, not least our president, presumably, right? And there have been pauperization and sort of povertization, if there's such a word, of white, Indian, and so-called colored, on the whole, it still remains highly racialized. In a recent meeting, I said something like this, unless it's misunderstood, that in the area that I come from near the university, half the traffic lights have got white people standing there begging. And no one wants any person of any color to be doing that at 8 o'clock at night. I mean, if you see a 60-year-old soul looking man, he may be 45, actually, he looks 60. Whether he's white or African or Indian or so-called colored, does it matter ultimately? Not to somebody like me, and I'm unapologetic about it. We do not want people to be begging at their age at a traffic light. So you got me wrong, but the rest of it, that's your view. I'm just clarifying the one point. Without big business, we are finished. We are more desperate for big business and international investment and domestic investment than ever before. So as long as that's understood, the rest of what you say, that's fine. That's your view. We can debate that at some stage. That's all. I'm not going to like go for a tit for tat. That won't be fair. But you see, colleagues, Treasury, the task before you from all parties, presumably, is to get a better sense of how you manage this process. It's the other parties that raised it. That's when it struck me. And when somebody used, I think it was my friend Willie used the word riots. He can use that word. I mean, Willie, the ANC comrades that use it, even here in my hometown, in meetings, they're using it. And I keep tackling them on it. That's my own comrades, Willie, not you. I'm just, and you have a right to say it, right? But what I'm simply saying is maybe we want to hear another point of view. Because a riot implies a mindless thing and it's structural. I think if you listen to the DA, Willie, you guys say the same thing. Obviously, the EFF says it. The only party here that, as I said, almost all parties, I remember that the FF doesn't take that position. But I can throw back to you, DA, the things you say about the inequalities and so on. Where we differ is, you know, on how to tackle them, on what time, what are the methods and so on. About looting and so on, the ANC itself openly admits that we have been the prime culprits in this. So I don't think that's a debate. Let's focus as a collective, despite our differences. I have never stopped anybody from expressing their point of view. I just don't want to be misunderstood. And everything you said, Pani, I imagine you would say. I just think you misunderstood my first point, but you may want to stick by your position, and you're free to do so. Now, let's throw it back to you, DG, and then members can come in again as they see fit. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Chair, and thank you very much for the comments that came through. My colleagues are also here. They will respond to some of the key questions. Maybe let me start with some of the comments that you made, Chair, around the joint committees and the need to present. We will always be ready and stand ready because you are right. I think the message has to be understood by all, and the message must actually be, you know, we must drive it home in terms of the impact as to what exactly happened and the impact on the economy. So that is something that we should continue. But just on the general points, obviously they are way above my pay grade for now. But I agree with the notion that says there's issue about opportunity, there's issue about access, there's issues about unemployment that we cannot shy away from. That you know many of our people in South Africa need access, need opportunity, and they're unemployed, and they really need to, in our programs as government, we need to take that into consideration. And that's the point I would just make, just generally, in terms of what you mentioned around Sastria. Sastria is, you know, interesting enough, Chair, Sastria has up to now, in many years, has been one of the only state-owned companies that has been giving us a dividend, by the way. Obviously, Telkom and our shares there will get here and there, 800, 900 million, depending as to when there's a dividend. But with Sastria, it has been doing well. It is the first time that we are going to actually backstopping them with about 3.9 billion, as we indicated in the support measures that we indicated. And also even that, it was not to say, you know, that's enough, but it was simply saying in terms of their profile, their financial profile, if they exceed certain thresholds, if they exceed 10 billion, if they exceed 15 billion, and if they are going to hit the 20 billion mark, they will need the shareholders to come in. And that's why we thought and engaged with them and say, we will keep 3.9 billion in case you're approaching the 20 billion. Now, ideally, they should actually be presenting to you, but I know I was also with them this morning at the DTIC, you know, committee, portfolio committee this morning, And they were saying their claims as we speak today are almost reaching the 20, between 15 and 20 billion mark, and that we have actually, they requested a meeting with us last night to meet with them, and we should meet them in the next few days just to fully understand where they are at. You know, they are funded mainly, Chair, not even from transfers from us, but they are supported by their own operations, and they acknowledge that their cover is very cheap. If you look at your car insurance, and there's a small 291 cents contribution there, but they can explain at the right time, and you can also give it some write up, Chair, just in terms of our subsidy structure and get the funding. So we are not solely dependent on us as government. So they've been running a good operation there, and we are quite happy that they are running a good show. Now, there's also a question around where does the money come from? I think the question is correct and it's relevant where we are at. We did announce a support to small businesses. DTIC will get, in total, there's an amount of 2.3 billion as part of the measures, and it's also a combination of their own money and a combination of new money that they're getting. There's in support for the 350 rand grant, which amounts to almost about 27 billion rand. Where is the money going to come from? All of members will remember that in the first quarter revenue performance, firstly, let me put up front, like we did in the past, we are not going to be going to the market and borrow this money. You know, we relied, and that was the explanation we gave at the time, we relied on the over collection from the revenue service in the first quarter. Again, in terms of today's presentation, you can see that that may not be the case moving forward because of what the impact that these riots have. So we are just so fortunate that we're able to have more money than anticipated, and then we are able to. Now, how are we going to do this? We will stick to the law in terms of how the money flows. This week Cindy was here, yesterday or today, but we did table section 6 provisions in the law, and section 16 provisions for these packets of measures to come into the process, and they will be, and they were referred to the relevant committees to start processing these two bills that that we presented as part of regularizing the money that we put out as support of the support package. So the legality of it is in motion, and we don't want to err on that one, and that's one thing that we will never do. There's also a question around whether we can recover. Look, we can recover. We can recover if the fundamentals that we know, and Duncan will speak a little bit more in his input just now around work that we do on the operation Vulindlela front, because that on its own and the work that we have to do around improving the performance of the economy, we're not sitting and not doing anything as government. I think there's more that we are doing, and then there's more that we need to do, and obviously more details will come through later as we are busy finalizing some of the thoughts based on the realities today that we need to do. Honourable Ogamp is clear, and I still maintain the same in terms of what the minister said. We cannot, there's no room for error. We have to make sure that we get things right, because our performance is just based on some of these things that we do. So in terms of how we administer the process, there's no error. In terms of how, what we need to, do as government in resolving or addressing those challenges that I spoke about earlier on, and that's what Honourable Members are talking about. It's important that we continue to be focused and continue that we implement the programs that we uplift the poor. And that's something that remains a challenge, and we have to continue doing that. Duncan, I don't know if you want to come in with some of the aspects, and maybe some of the colleagues here, with Puso Vuyo and Yolanda, if you want to come in also, please feel free if I left any. But Duncan, let me give it over to you to respond to some of the broad aspects and around slide 6, and also around the issue around the 8-9%, 6% that Honourable Karim is talking about, and maybe other questions. Thank you very much, Duncan.
Yep, thanks, DG.
Go ahead, Duncan.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, DG. Yes, the I think so. Just on the specific question about the exchange rate, and then maybe I'll talk a little bit about Operation Vulindlela as requested. The honourable member asked why our currency is so volatile. I think there are two parts of that question. The one is our currency does look volatile relative to an average, because the other line on that chart is just an average of other emerging market currencies. But even if you were to compare us to some of our emerging market peers specifically, our currency is relatively volatile. And there are a couple of reasons for that, but I guess the one of the most intuitive ways of thinking about it is that our economy, as we've seen recently, is still very much tied to what happens in global commodity prices, and therefore very tied to the global commodity cycle and what happens to the prices of some of the major commodities that we produce. And so, of course, if you have an economy that is linked to something else that is fairly volatile, like commodity prices, then that does show up in some of your macro fundamentals, in particular on your exchange rate, because it is a reflection of the demand for your currency relative to other currencies. And of course, firms and buyers of our commodities do need to purchase dollars and rands in order to trade in those commodities. There are some other reasons as well, which has to do with the manner in which our currency is traded. It's a very highly traded currency. There are also some global risk dynamics that does have an implication for our currency as well. But I think you know, sort of one of the main drivers historically has certainly been the commodity prices, and we're seeing that now as well. So if you look at how the currency has strengthened this year, it really is on the back of those very, very strong commodity prices that we've seen since the beginning of the year. DG, on Operation Vulindlela, I think, you know, again, we have had a request. And I think it was from SCOA to talk specifically about Operation Vulindlela. And I think they will get into a bit more detail. But really what it is it's a joint initiative between the presidency and the Treasury to accelerate some of these structural reforms. And the reason that is important and the reason why it's important for us to work with the line departments to push those structural reforms across the line is because we really do think that that is the best way for us to raise our long-run growth and the best way for us to create jobs and to raise the living standards of South Africans. So there have been some early successes that the departments have delivered with the support of Operation Vulindlela. Of course, the most recent one being the unlocking of private investment in embedded generation. And there have been others. And I think it's important for us to continue working as the presidency and the Treasury with other line departments to make sure that we get those structural reforms across the line. I'll ask DG, with your permission, Boipuso, just to talk to, there was a question about the potential impact of future lockdowns or future unrest on economic growth. It's obviously something she and her team are thinking about as they prepare the forecast, because it's very important for the fiscal framework. So I'll ask her to come in on that. And I think we've covered all the questions. Thank you, Chair and honourable members.
Thanks, Duncan.
Thank you, Duncan. Good afternoon, honourable members. Good afternoon, Chair. So briefly on the question on the impact of follow-up lockdowns and potential unrest, what we've learned over time
Hello? The Parliament requires, when you're speaking, unless it's ruled out because of connection problems, for you to put your video on, please, right? It's not my rule. I don't care for such things, but Parliament requires it.
Sure.
So can you put your video on, please? Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Not a problem. Thank you, Chair. So to respond to the question, I think in answering what the impact of future lockdowns will be. What we've seen over time is that the nature of the lockdown, firstly, has material impact on what it does to economic growth. So if we look historically, for instance, at hard lockdown level 4 and level 5 that we saw in June of last year, it had significant and negative impact on economic growth because of the nature of the lockdown itself. So many sectors of the economy were prohibited from operating, whereas as we've seen over time with the adjusted lockdowns approach, the more nuanced and the more targeted the lockdown, the less impact it has on growth, just because most sectors of the economy are still operational. So what we saw, if we look at some of the information we have from the lockdown we saw at the beginning of this year, the augmented level 3 lockdown had very different impacts on growth to what we saw with the initial level 3 lockdown, and that was because it was more targeted at specifically more contact-intensive sectors. So we saw a curtailment of economic activity, which was a little bit more focused, more contact-intensive sectors, as well to the extent that we saw alcohol sales bans. Those industries and related industries in alcohol consumption and sales were affected along with their related value chains. So and as well transport services, because the curtailment of human interaction would have implications on just how much those services were used. So to answer the question in a more succinct way, what we're finding is the nature of the lockdown matters, and to the extent that it is targeted and affects contact-intensive services and sectors, and also affects people's mobility, sectors that are directly or most directly impacted by that will be the most affected by the lockdown. So that would be the first. The second question, if I've understood correctly, was in the event that we see another incident of unrest, what would that mean for the economy? And again, I think the nature of the unrest matters. So to the extent that it is contained quite quickly and doesn't affect value chain significantly, doesn't result in significant shutdowns in economic activity, and isn't associated with significant damage to infrastructure and property, then we might see a more muted impact. But to the extent that we see significant or protracted phases of unrest, then they would have quite significant impacts on economic growth just because of the nature of the disruption. And as Duncan had mentioned, excuse me, in his presentation earlier, the extent to which it has sort of second round impacts and to the extent that it's going to have a lasting impact on the economy still remains to be seen. The literature has shown that there tends to be a lasting impact, and to the extent that significant economic infrastructure is damaged, that will also likely have significant impact on the economy's ability to recover from those initial or those incidences of unrest. So I hope that answers the question, and if there are any follow-ups, please feel free to ask and I'll be able to answer. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else, PG?
No, Chair. I think we have attempted to answer all the questions. Thank you.
Okay. I just want to ask some clarity. Was this fully addressed? You see, in your figures, DG, you talk about 44% have closed temporarily of these businesses, right? That were demolished by the unrest. Now, when you say 44% have closed temporarily, is this that they will be revived, or you don't know whether they'll be revived?
Excuse me, Chair.
Sorry?
Hi, Chair. Yes? I've got two hands from Mr. Ocamp and Mr. Ryder. Sorry.
Yeah, sure. Okay, Willie and Dennis, thank you.
Thank you, Eunice. Yeah, Eunice, just in reply to what you said, I think it is very important, Chair, that we must not make the mistake and think that we agree with you. I'm glad that Fani also came out and said that, but I want to say it from our side as well. Whether you call this riots or an insurrection or whatever you call this, it is clear what led up to this. You do not burn a school out of poverty. You do not rob or break down the doors of a blood bank out of frustrations with poverty. I think I always tell my kids that in order to solve a problem, you must admit what the problem is. And I think for us, and I know it might not be the object of today's discussion, is to go to the root of what happened here. But I think once you've got, like you just did, Chairperson, go into what you think the reasons are for what happened here, then we must have the right, and thank you for giving us that right to reply. But I think it's very important for us to admit, and for us as a government, and I think especially for the ANC, to admit what is going on here. What happened here was due to infighting within the ANC, period. I'm on the call. Sorry, Chairperson, you must protect me. Thank you, Dikeledi. That is my opinion. Right, and I think that whatever...
No, I know you won't agree with me, but go ahead. Yeah,
sure,
fine.
Thank you. The fact of the matter is just that we are sitting here today talking about the financial implications of this, but tiptoeing around what was the reasons for this. We must look it into the eyes and say, this was not only due to poverty. And if it was poverty, what was the role that the governing party since 1994 played in that? We just saw the unemployment figures getting out. The expanded unemployment figures are standing at 44.4%. Good golly, that is terrible. We will forever have poverty in our country if our country are managed in the same way as it was since 1994, well, especially the last 10, 15 years. My question with regards to policy issues such as expropriation and other issues that has got a huge effect on our credit ratings, our cost of borrowing, our stability, that has not been answered. If we want to alleviate poverty, we must do job creation. And job creation is not for a government to do. A government can't create jobs by employing more people in municipalities or in provincial governments or in state departments. The main way in which job creation will take place, Honorable Chairperson, is if you create an environment that is conducive for investment. And I've said that many times in the past on this platform and during our meetings. But it seems to me that whatever government does, it is contra creating an environment conducive for investment. So we can say poverty, poverty, but we are not doing what is required to be done in order for us to really stop poverty, and that is by job creation. And I would like to get the answer on that, on issues such as expropriation, such as this new forced pension contribution wants to be made. That's not going to help to create confidence out there for people that must come and invest in our country, because that is what we need to create jobs. That is what will alleviate poverty, not all these silly politics playing policies that is going on. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Who's next?
Thanks, Chair. I think it was me.
Dennis and then Dikeledi. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, great. Chair, I don't want to labor any points, and I'm lucky enough to have been chosen to debate tomorrow on the subject, so I'm not necessarily going to enter the fray. But just to make the point, we do all disagree, and it is a debate, and it's something that's worth having. So let's talk about it tomorrow in the appropriate forum. Chair, I was pleased to hear that we have someone from Treasury who deals with the projections. And I wanted to then pose a different question, because we did speak about the fact that it was too soon to tell. But certainly if we've got someone who's dealing with some of the projections, perhaps then I can ask some questions around revenue collection, which I wanted to ask. And I think it is too soon really to see what the impact of the insurrection was on the revenue collection. But if one looks at the markets and monitors the reactions that they've had, I think there's a general acceptance that there was a massive impact, a big negative impact on a big part of the economy. The fact is that the subsequent rebuilding focus is also going to have a positive impact. Now, we mustn't say that that's a good thing. We shouldn't have to rebuild stuff because other people have broken it down wantonly. But, it's going to have, in the bigger scheme of things, somewhat of a balancing effect. It may not balance out totally, but then of course one needs to work out how many of these businesses that are temporarily closed are going to remain permanently closed. So just to get an idea from Treasury in terms of their projections, you know, are we projecting big reductions in revenue collection, certainly for July, perhaps also for August, then a bit of a recovery, and then what going forward? Because I think, you know, we must admit that there are many of those shops that will not be able to reopen, and that's going to have a direct impact on the economy. Thank you, Chair.
Dikeleri, please.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Good afternoon to members and team treasurer. Chair, I did apologize through the chat group for joining late. I was still in the plenary. Chair, I just want to merge the two inputs by Honorable Ryder and Honorable Okamp. That to a certain extent, Honorable Ryder, when he started speaking, he responded to, he actually said what I wanted to say in what was raised by Honorable Okamp. I think there's a platform tomorrow for debating, and we should not bring matters into this committee and politicize the matter. We are facing a situation as a country, and we need to come up with a solution and entertain the presentation and the attempts that the Treasury are doing in terms of resolving the issues. We should be part of the resolution and not keep on blaming or pointing fingers. I appreciate. And I'm also happy that you still remember. I think it's honorable to do it. Who still remember what the former minister Tito Mboweni said? There's no money, but the problem needs to be solved. And if it comes to a push, which we think, we don't know, which we think Treasury or government will find itself in corner to go and borrow to resolve the issues. We need to resolve these issues. And my plea, Chairperson, is that let us not politicize these issues. And I'm happy with what Team Treasury are saying and want to say that I'm agreeing with you that this is a continuous engagement. And it's too early for them because they are still trying, coming with ideas, still engaging with other organs or institutions where to find money. So I'm pleading, Honorable Okamp, through you, Chair, I'm sorry to address you directly, Honorable Okamp. Let's not get there. Where I said you are getting. I know you don't want to fight. We are not the fighting type. Thank you, Chair.
Firstly, DG, can I just draw attention to this? Maybe I lost it. It's possible my mind drifted, but that 44%, right, that question still remains. I want some clarity. Are those people in small business that are closed temporarily? What does the word temporarily mean? I won't repeat that for the third time, right? Secondly, I think that, I think I was a bit surprised myself, but I think that view is shared. I can't speak for the others, but I think the view is shared by many, maybe the majority in this committee, that you came up with this 36 billion rand rescue package, so to speak. Quite quickly, I was a bit surprised you were able to do it. I know you mentioned in the media, the minister, yourself and others, that it was partly that you were able to do this because of the rise in revenues, because of the commodity boom, right? Now, I don't know enough, nor can you predict
But obviously, across all parties, we agree. I'm not sure why we're quibbling over the things that we agree on. That the key thing is to get economic growth going. And that means investment, both from the domestic business and international business. And the point is that this unrest, as well as the COVID circumstances, undermine the prospect for that. But the question is, in your projections at the moment, is this commodity cycle, that we should never become, as you know, more than us, well, more than me, over-dependent on that, right? Because it's a cyclical thing and, you know, it's great for now. But is there some sense that the commodity boom, the cycle at the moment, is still likely to last? Because that will help us. And the same point that Dennis raised, I wanted to raise, about revenues, that at the moment it seems that the, you know, mining sector is rescuing us to a large extent, right? But now, given that we're going to lose a lot of revenue because businesses are closed down, and, you know, even municipalities are giving businesses that have, you know, been demolished a space to, like, revitalize by telling them, okay, you don't have to pay rates for the year that's coming and so on, which means now you'll be troubled because municipalities not be getting the revenue. I mean, some of these are huge factories and industrial producers. And, you know, that means, I don't know, they'll be looking for more money from the equitable share. Then the third thing to say is, you know, this thing is worrying that the Molitania raised, right, about Mr. Molitania, about the defense force. I picked it up and a former minister raised it with me in a WhatsApp exchange, that you can't have the army being hungry and not getting enough food and so on. You know, in many parts of the developing world, that produces challenges for the state. And they've been pushed to the extreme. In fact, they had to prepare, as you know, more than me, for yesterday and the possibilities that, particularly in this province and parts of Gauteng, this thing of an unrest could flare up. So those who say, let's make the environment conducive to growth, of course, but many of us also feel it should also look into reducing inequalities, because one of the key things that people like you know more than me, DG, is that in countries of huge inequality, you can't get, whether racialized inequality or other or highly racialized, doesn't make any difference. Inequalities don't produce the conditions for economic growth. You can only have sustainable growth if you reduce inequalities, but you only can reduce inequalities to some extent if you have economic growth. So on the defense force, can you say something? I mean, this is really worrying. I know the coffers are empty, but, you know, this can create quite challenging circumstances for us. On the issue of the social fund, just to clarify, we don't know fully to what extent this is, as I understand it, DG, processed through the cabinet and a formal cabinet green paper. A green paper, as I understand it, colleagues, is not a final paper. It's a discussion paper. So that's how it should be seen. It's not a white paper, it's a green paper. So there's no harm in coming out of the green paper, but obviously cabinet needs to apply its mind to it, and I don't know if that happened or not. But at this stage, the social fund, in principle, is what I'm saying. I would imagine quite a few people would support. The only issue is the terms of it and how it's done and so on. Obviously, as Monle Makanya and other the excellent editor of the editor-in-chief of City Press pointed out on Sunday, it's not just that people don't want it. They may well want it. I think it's a subtext of what he's saying. But they don't trust the government because of the way we've mismanaged funds and how much has been lost to corruption, as the Zondo Commission points out, and as government itself points out, really. So partly the problems we have, those who say, well, it's also the ANC looting. I agree with that. I think the ANC agrees with it. But that is not the sole explanation. I think also, obviously we're going to disagree, but the point, at least I thought that the DA, from what I know of the DA, does point to the inequalities. I'm not saying you agree on what I say, but you do point to the unsustainable inequalities. That's all I was saying. I don't want an endless debate, and people are free to have the views that they want. And yes, we can debate it tomorrow, but that doesn't mean we can't engage on it today, because you can't answer a question, colleagues, whatever the point of view. How can you answer a question like, how do you prepare for this happening again
unless you know why it happened. So it's inevitable. We can't have a full-blown discussion here. Maybe that should be put on the agenda, not just our committee. But you can't say, okay, DG, can you explain to us how Treasury is going to prepare to contain or preempt or reduce the possibilities of this happening again, unless you understand the cause? So the question was posed not by me, by other colleagues. And all I simply said, I'm sure there's some degree of consensus over this. Yes, the ANC is responsible. In any democracy, if there's poverty, ultimately, everybody can, to some or other extent, be blamed for it. Those who want to pay more taxes, those who don't perform in their jobs, in civil society, and in the state, yes. But ultimately, the governing party is responsible for a democracy. So obviously, the ANC is primarily responsible even for that poverty. I don't think anybody can argue. I mean, not even the most ideologically blind person can say that what happened in the... So nobody said that today. I don't know where that comes from. All I was simply pointing out, DJ, unless you misunderstand me, I'm addressing you and Treasury. I'm saying don't focus only on those who organized it from within the ANC. Yes, of course, the people who support President Zuma, he's an ANC former president, are ANC members. They have orchestrated this. The ANC itself admits it. The president talks of an attempted insurrection. There is not an insurrection. But even then, there's an acknowledgement that this is linked to some other extent. All I'm simply saying, colleagues, is whatever our views about the performance of the ANC, let us not distract from the structural issues. And I explained the structural issues are highly but not solely racialized. So I don't see actually what you're saying, Willie, that you're right to express your point of view, I understand, but it's based on a lot of things that I didn't say. Actually, I don't say it. Maybe you think a lot of people, I never said it's a poverty issue. I said there were 4x4s and so on. But let's not be naive. Let me put it that way. I don't know who he is, but okay, let me withdraw that. Let us not be like basing our point of view on some sort of panacea tomorrow afternoon when the debate takes place. That is only part of an ongoing process. Treasury has to deliver the money. Together with its other departments and government, it has to come to terms with what caused the problem. Similarly, parliamentary committees can't function blindly. Like, you know, let's look at solutions without knowing what caused them so that we can actually address the solutions properly and, in fact, deal with the matter others raise. Let's try to avoid this happening again. So in short, I think that, you know, Treasury, that the more I listen to you and my colleagues, that this input needs to be made more, let's say, circulate more in Parliament, both houses, and I'll do my bit. Remember, I don't have sway over the National Assembly, powers that be, but I will now ring the chair of the, unless people disagree, but if the majority agree, I'm going ahead, chair of committees in the first instance, the chief whip, and they will take it up with the House chair. We can have the debate. That's not going to, you know, as I said, that's not going to, well, you know, people will all sides posture and blame game, as the lady says. But what we need is a question answered. For maybe one option, DG, is to see if we can get the economic cluster committees on both sides to meet. And with virtual meetings now, we can find the time. But, you know, all I'm saying, colleagues, is that look at the value of this, the input. Even though we know a lot of it, but when it comes together, and also the questions that inevitably get raised. Okay, there's no harm in debate, and there's no harm in differences with multi-party democracy. Nor is there any harm in different people within the broad front like the ANC taking different positions. Ultimately, the majority in the ANC give the mandates, and in fact, so it is with other parties. Okay, over then to the DG and his team.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you very much. I think you, again, the issues you are mentioning are quite important, and I agree with them. There's a question, a comment that you're requesting from us on the Defence Force. What we did, you know, in this package of support, we increased the budget of defense and allocated about 700 million rand to the Department of Defense as part of this, you know, intervention that they made. And look, I'm not a security person, but the reality is that they will assess the situation with the security cluster and how long they will be in the post that they are at now will obviously be based on the assessment that they will make. But what we've made sure that they don't go hungry, just, you know, responding directly. We also gave the police 300 million over and above what was allocated in February so that they are able to address what may come as budget pressures, you know. And then, you know, the indication at the point, one did not get any pushback around the amounts. Even though there are pressures, one can imagine that they will be able, with the extra, you know, deployment that they made, the 700 million and 300 million rand for defense and police respectively should be enough under the circumstances. And as we engage with them on a monthly basis, we obviously will see as time goes on, and we've got an opportunity again coming about the adjustment budget, if any at all money will be needed. But so far, you know, that indication has not come through. Secondly, just Chair, in terms of the social fund, I think what we, the choice and the option we took as a treasury was not to get into a cat fight with the Department of Social Development. I think all we said was that it is a green paper, yes, you're right, for discussion, but all we're saying is that it's important the way we see that must also go through cabinet and that itself. The bigger issue to discuss in this is the whole social security reform agenda. Because it's not only about this fund, but it's also about a whole lot of other reforms on this front. And this we know have been obviously discussed in NATLEC, and it's important to also give that process a chance to unfold. And also for cabinet to give, and also within the government system for us as treasury to give our view, and so that we have got one composite view around how to approach this. And obviously, this calls for a whole lot of other things that you know. You know, if we want us to zoom in into the social relief of distress, as an example, the 350 rand, is it enough? There's a view that says this is a good start for a basic income grant. That conversation to actually mature in government, and then we can decide. Because there's also a view, and we picked up in this view in this meeting, that says maybe we must make sure that we provide for more for the vulnerable. There's another view that says we're already a welfare state anyway. Why do you want to give more? Why don't you give more to improving, you know, more resources towards, job creation, unlike just making money available to as grants in the way we are doing. These are contesting views, and I think government on the day should actually obviously articulate its final view. And as officials, we can only advise. As officials, we can only take cue from the governing party's policy views and policy positions. And I think we will advise, but however the governing party on the day will have its view, implemented as they are the ruling party. You know, that cannot change, because we work in a political environment, and we've accepted that the whole political administrative dichotomy is quite an interesting one. And at any given point in time, we have to make sure that we balance that very clearly. And so far, I think as a treasurer, we are able to do that because of the advice that we give and the facts that we put on the table for proper decisions that are evidence-based can be taken in a way. So Duncan, I know there were a whole lot of comments and questions that you want to talk to. Maybe let me give you the opportunity, including maybe responding to both Honorable Ryder and Honorable Karim around the 44%. This thing will close temporarily, and then what that slide meant, and then what we mean, whether it is will be reviewed later as a result of the fact that maybe they need support to just check up the business once more. Duncan, please.
Thanks.
Before you go, I forgot, colleagues, Duncan, before you come in, just a quick thing. Zolani Mkiva is not here, he tells me, because he's not well, okay? So it's only because he's sick, really, he's not here. And we wish him well on behalf of the community. So.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, DG. Yeah, there were a few questions around the commodity cycle as well. I'll ask Boipuso and Vuyo just to touch on the small business questions and the and some of those other ones. Boipuso, can you kick us off, please?
Sure, Duncan, no problem. So in terms of the number of small businesses that have been shut down and, you know, how many can actually be resuscitated, it remains to be seen. Unfortunately, it's too soon to say. But what we do know is that the health of those businesses prior to the unrest would determine their ability to essentially weather the storm. And given what we know generally of businesses and their vulnerabilities, we know that smaller businesses that aren't part of entrenched and well-established value chains tend to be more susceptible to significant changes in their cash flows and sort of shocks to their planned operating environment. So it remains too soon to say, but initially that's the sort of thinking that informs our concern around small businesses in particular in light of their vulnerabilities. The second question around our view on revenue projections and what they might be, as DG had mentioned earlier on in the opening in his opening remarks, we aren't in a position where we can explicitly state what our position is on revenue, but what we can say at this point is that based on what we've seen in economic activity and resultantly revenue collections, the first half of the year has been quite a mixed one, with the combination of lockdowns as well as load shedding, which we had indicated as some of the key risks to economic growth at the time of the budget, materializing since then, but also that being counterbalanced with an innate sense of momentum in the economy, which a lot of forecasters, including ourselves, at the time of the budget had underestimated, and that was reflected in the first quarter GDP outcome, which surprised to the upside. So what we are currently contending with as we consider our second quarter and obviously thinking about the MPBPS forecast as well, is what the net effect of this balance of forces is going to be. Our sense of it is that, as we mentioned in the presentation earlier, the impact of the lockdowns to mitigate the spread of the pandemic will have some impact, particularly on the sectors that I've spoken to earlier. We're also taking into consideration the fact that the impact of the unrest as well will have an dampening impact on potential economic growth and what we expect to see in growth outcomes for the second quarter and going into the MPBPS. And this as well in an environment where we've seen sort of more acute bouts of load shedding in June in particular, as well as I think going into July as well, which will have significant impact on the extent of the economy and its resilience to weather some of the storm that these shocks have posed. This against that innate economic momentum that I'd spoken to earlier sort of puts us in a situation where we're trying to balance and assess the net effect and what this means for economic growth. And now this matters because it's going to be essentially, it will have impact on the tax basis and subsequently our view on what revenues can be collected. Now, Duncan had rightly indicated that the commodity cycle is providing some upward pressure in terms of what can happen to the supportiveness of the external sector. And the extent to which this will last, we don't know at this point. Views are quite disparate at this point. Our sense of it is that certainly for 2021, we're seeing these commodities holding up. The extent to which it will last and when it will turn is still remains to be seen, and we're watching that data closely as we consider our forecasts. I'm not sure if there was a third question. No, I don't think any other ones that directly relate to growth, but if there is anything else, please do feel free to ask and I'll address them. Thank you.
Thank you. Who's next? Okay, is there anybody who feels their question hasn't been fully answered or wants to take any issue further for now?
Vuyo is going to come on answering some of the basic.
Oh, right. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. No, I actually just wanted to come in to clarify the question around the 44. percent of small businesses. We've also had touched on it, but that number actually comes from a survey by the Beyond COVID Research Initiative. This is actually a consortium of small businesses themselves. So this was the initial survey that they did shortly in the aftermath of the unrest and surveying their members. And that's where you get that response where 5% were saying they're still open and running, and the remainder saying that they were not. And then the follow-up question to say, well, when do you plan to reopen? So you might find that if they run another survey, let's say in a month's time, you could get a slightly different proportion of businesses saying that they intend to remain closed permanently versus those that intend to reopen. And as we've also indicated, we know that small businesses are quite vulnerable. So the factors that are going to influence their ability to reopen are many and quite varied. We are working at, you know, considering issues around grants. There have already been announcements by the DTI and the Small Business Department, but of course, these may not be sufficient for all businesses to cover and recoup their losses. So to the extent that there's a funding gap, you might see some businesses not reopen. To the extent that the supply chains that they're part of remain disruptive, they may not reopen. To the extent that enabling economic infrastructure around them that allowed them to operate is not repaired or not repaired timeously, that will also impact their ability to reopen and, I suppose, over time, their willingness to reopen. And then you have sort of non-economic, maybe slightly more psychological factors, like the fact that many small business owners indicate that they feel a sense of personal betrayal, particularly if the unrest occurred in communities that they are part of. And so even if you have a very small funding gap and an ability to reopen, you might still have a situation where small business owners just feel that it's not worth it. So obviously, we remain very concerned about this, given the potential that small businesses have for employment generation. And we'll certainly be keeping an eye on these surveys going forward. We'll probably have more concrete data around this at the time of the MTBPS.
Yeah, you know, what you're saying, Vuyo, is, I mean, I partly understood that. And, you know, the way you speak, it sort of confirms one's concerns. But that's as it is. So you're telling us as it is. Is there anybody else you have, DT, wants to say anything from your side?
No, Chair, we are fine for now. Thank you.
All right. Let's see. This is an ongoing process, which doesn't mean we're going to hold you before the committee. No, our committee for now has to let you go. But, you know, if it's possible, maybe at the most we can get all NCOP committees together. And you know, you can do an input for all of us, understanding that you, DG, may not be available. But you're a very competent team. And let me also say this to you, DG. Every now and then, and fairly often, we see new people, like both the women who came on today. I don't recall having seen them before. You and Duncan, we know. And then there's been a number of them, women in particular, who have surfaced over the last year and a half, Mampu and so on. Very competent, very impressive. We may not agree with them on broad issues and, in fact, Treasury. But, you know, it's good. These are young people coming on. Soon we will be telling you, DG, like we tell your brother, it's time to move on. Well, starting with me, obviously, but that's another matter. Okay. Well, it's not another matter. It is a matter I have already applied my mind to. It's not for me to discuss here. And anyway, I'm tired of listening to myself, DG. So you can see the stress of listening to oneself. Now, what do I see here? There's nothing here. Look, there's finally Esther and Poppy, if they're on. I know they don't like speaking, but then they could surely put questions if they want to. So the stuff on there is mostly about apologies because people came late and the plenary and so on that the NCOP is having. So I don't see any more hands up. So do I take it, colleagues, this is part of an ongoing process? Obviously, when it comes to the broader issues of the nature, causes, and possible preemptive and other strategies that we as Parliament think the executive should take and we ourselves should take in our oversight work, we will discuss tomorrow, but that will not sort the problem out. There will be further discussions, and at least in this sort of interactive process with the executive, you know, we get more out of it than, you know, the blabber on all sides, not least from somebody like me, when we're taking very strong party political positions in a debate in the House, as is the want of most MPs in most parliaments in the world. That's the way it works, for better or for worse. But at least it's a democracy, and everybody's allowed to speak within the limits of the Constitution on what you can and cannot say. Okay, thank you all for your forbearance and understanding and for your contribution. We meet tomorrow wearing another cap at 9 a.m. Am I right, Dicky Lady? I think she's not around, is she? Oh, she's muted or whatever. All right, fine. 9 o'clock tomorrow is appropriations. Thank you all. Bye then.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.